Thank you for two very wonderful selections this morning. Enjoyed them both. I believe we're both of these ones that Steve Hitches during our service auction, one of the things Sandra put up for auction was somebody could choose the choir music for a morning. And so, Steve, thanks for an excellent choice. And if you'd like to do this next year, come to the service auction and get high. One of my hobbies, if that's the right term for it, is keeping an eye out for cultural markers. A cultural marker is, as I'm using the term here, is an event or a happening, piece of writing, basically anything that offers some kind of a clue as to our prevailing cultural climate. Such markers are not as telling as scientifically conducted surveys or anything like that. They're more like straws in the wind that may offer an indicator as to which way the wind out there is blowing. Well, one such straw I have watched blow by recently has to do with a gentleman who has become a target for various pundits and spokespersons of the religious, political, and cultural right in this country as their latest liberal bad guy. And at first I thought I was hearing the name wrong because the gentleman under fire is Clint Eastwood. Clint Eastwood? I thought, you know, are we talking about the same Clint Eastwood here who's, I think back in the mid-70s, his vigilante police officer character, Dirty Harry Callahan, gave the more moderate-minded types on the San Francisco Police Force fits, and whose line, "Go ahead, make my day," became President Reagan's mantra in some of his dealings with Congress? Or is this the same Clint Eastwood, whom President Richard Nixon once appointed to the National Council on the Arts as a conservative counterweight to the alleged liberals on that body? Or could this be the same Clint Eastwood who during the 1980s was the Republican mayor of Carmel, California? This is a town where if you're house shopping and can find something going for a mere $1 million, you are looking at best at a one-bedroom condo. Well, as a matter of fact, it is that Clint Eastwood. He's recently been labeled a purveyor of, quote, liberal propaganda by Rush Limbaugh and various other such self-appointed protectors of all that is supposedly right, good, and moral in our society have weighed in with similar kinds of denunciations. I look at all this and I wonder, what did the guy do? Mary Barbara Streisand, maybe I did. That would be an interesting couple, but that's not it. No, what he has done is direct and co-star in a movie about a female boxer called Million Dollar Baby. Full disclosure, I have not seen this movie. I have read enough review and commentary about it, however, to at least get some sense of the alleged sins of Mr. Eastwood. The problem, as I gather it anyway, is not with the main plot, in which Mr. Eastwood plays an aging, kind of has-been boxing trainer who agrees to be the trainer for a young woman who sees a career in women's boxing as a way out of her impoverished upbringing and her otherwise dead-end life. And every review I've read has also insisted that it is not a female rival. Okay. It is the subplot in Million Dollar Baby that seems to be kicking up the ruckus. Another of the principal characters in this movie gets a spinal cord injury, rendering him completely immobile, and as a result, he wants to die. This subplot apparently revolves around the issue of whether or not this character's wish should, by some means or other, be granted. There's a priest in this film also, played by Brian O'Byrne, who gets into the act here, and with whom the character Clint Eastwood is playing, who is in the film a lifelong Catholic, engages in some rather intense conversation with this priest about certain points of religious doctrine as they relate to what to do in part about the guy with the spinal injury. So moral issues about active euthanasia and assisted suicide come into play. Now, I don't even know how this movie turns out. For all the commentary I've read, I can't find anyone who's willing to give away the ending. So if you've seen it, don't tell me. I'm going to go see it and find out for myself. But the marker I'm seeing here is really not the movie itself anyway, so much as it is the response it has generated, at least generated in some quarters. The very suggestion that there could be some moral ambiguity as to what constitutes a worthwhile and livable life, and that there could be some reasonable points of difference over quality of life issues is apparently not to be tolerated. The very suggestion that there is always a direct connect-the-dots line that can be drawn between established religious doctrine on the one hand and hard moral choices on the other is apparently more than some of the self-anointed protectors of our common virtue can countenance. In fact, it must seem like the ultimate betrayal to them. Dirty Harry Callahan, the tough cop hero, has, in his advancing years, become a moral relativist. This is one of those markers, actually, I have to say, that leaves me more amused than appalled. It's probably going to provide some fodder for a few more rounds of right-wing radio before its shelf life runs out. And it goes the way of the Passion of Christ, which, as you probably remember, was all the talk of the town about this time a year ago. I guess this time around it's million-dollar baby. Okay. What I find more sobering and take more seriously is an opinion voiced last November by the American historian, author, and cultural and political commentator Gary Wills. It's another cultural marker with a little more gravitas to it than the million-dollar baby one. Wills maintained back in November in a New York Times op-ed column that he occasionally writes that the United States can no longer claim to be an Enlightenment country or a country born out of the ideals of the European Enlightenment of the 17th, 18th centuries. Now that sounds a little over the top until you read the case and he makes it fairly cogent. First, Wills offers this historical perspective. America, the first real democracy in history, was a product of Enlightenment values. Critical intelligence, tolerance, respect for evidence, and a regard for the secular sciences. Though the founders differed on many things, they shared these values of what was then called modernity. They addressed a candid world, as they wrote in the Declaration of Independence, out of a decent respect for the opinions of mankind. Close quote. It was based on these same Enlightenment values, I would add, and Mr. Wills would agree, since he's indicated this other places, that many of these same founders wrote and ratified a completely secular United States Constitution, deliberately devoid of any references to a deity. These founders, most of them, were devoutly religious persons. And I don't question at all that their religious views shaped their overall vision of the country that they were creating. No argument from me on that. But when it came to matters of civil governance, they stuck to the principles of the Enlightenment and of modernity. When it came to creating a form of government, they were secularists. That's part of Mr. Wills' argument, and he's completely right on that score. To return to his piece for another minute or two, he then cites several examples of how he sees the American populace at large and in disturbing measure forsaking these values, these Enlightenment values on which the nation was founded. A lot of things he says. At one point he asks, can a people that believes more fervently in the virgin birth than in evolution still be called an enlightened nation? And then he rolls out his big guns. The secular states of modern Europe do not understand the fundamentalism of the American electorate. It is not what they have experienced from this country in the past. Where else in the world do we find fundamentalist zeal, a raised secularity, religious intolerance, and fear of and hatred for modernity? Not in France, or Britain, or Germany, or Italy, or Spain. We find it in the Muslim world, in Al-Qaeda, in Saddam Hussein's Sunni loyalists. Americans wonder that the rest of the world thinks us so dangerous, so single-minded, so impervious to international appeals. They fear jihad, no matter whose zeal is being expressed. Close quote again. Well, I have to take issue with the comparison Wills draws here, if that's what he's doing, between our homegrown American fundamentalism and that being expressed in certain parts of the Muslim world. I think his penchant for hyperbole probably got the better of him when he got to that particular line. And I also have to note that he wrote these words the day after last November's presidential election and before, it seems, he had a chance to take a deep breath or two. But his larger point, I feel, is still well taken. The question of whether or not we as a society and nation still retain the right to call ourselves an enlightened nation, I think is a reasonable one and a valid one. Or at least it's reasonable to ask to what extent we can still call ourselves a nation in this day and age. I have to notice that there is less and less political capital to be gained these days by holding forth in the social and political arena for those enlightenment values of critical intelligence, respect for evidence, and regard for the secular sciences that Will cites. There are numerous examples of this that I could offer. In the interest of time, I will give just one. Take a look a few miles to the south of us, where the current governor of the state of Massachusetts positions himself, by good indication, for run of the presidency by strongly opposing the use of stealth research, and finding a cure for some of our more debilitating diseases and illnesses. So what does any of this have to do with our being a community of faith, as I've titled this sermon for today? I guess I better leave myself enough time to take that one up. Since, with the help of Mr. Wells, we're already dabbling in American history, let's dabble for a few minutes more. Like the founders of this nation, the initial founders and definers of our liberal religious heritage on this continent were also, for the most part, creatures and proponents of the Enlightenment, and of the principles and values, as already noted, that this movement represented. And they were also men and women of faith. Their faith was in the power of the human mind, informed by reason, to discover and affirm new truths about the world that was unfolding before them as the scientific era dawned. And their faith was also in the strength and the ability of the human heart and the human soul to find meaning and purpose and direction and value and moral guidance in human living by drawing upon one's religious principles and values. Their faith was one in which a religious or spiritual consciousness and a critical and discerning mind were not at odds with each other, but were instead compatible. And some of these folk called themselves Unitarians, and some called themselves Universalists, which depended much more upon their social standing than their theology. And initially, they lived out their Enlightenment religion in a Christian context, looking primarily to Jesus as the prime teacher and guide for living what they call a godly life. And we know in time they moved beyond that context, but we have never completely discarded it. Well, I point all this out not to simply toss out what is maybe an historical tidbit, but to impress upon you as strongly as I can that we here, those of us who are members of this congregation, are the inheritors of this liberal faith tradition. This is the tradition you signed on to when you signed our membership card, those of you who have done so. No, you did not sign on to a particular political agenda at any point on the political spectrum. You did not sign on to a particular political philosophy, but rather to the idea, among other things, that the common good is best advanced by the use of a critical, questioning, and unfettered mind, and the compassionate, justice-seeking heart. This is the faith which one of our spiritual ancestors, Thomas Jefferson, spoke when he said, "I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man, or human mind, as we would rightly put it today." We know Jefferson had his serious human failings, but I think he still pretty well nailed it on that one. Those words, by the way, are carved in stone. They're carved in stone at the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, D.C., and it occurs to me it wouldn't hurt for some of the higher-ranking powers that be in that city to stroll over to the Jefferson Memorial and give it a read now and then. This kind of stance was among the components of the faith of our founders. And this is the faith we are called upon to embody today. It is one of the reasons we are here. If, as Mr. Wells and others suggest, we are now in the midst of a cultural cycle, and I'm hoping and I am trusting that that is all that it is, that we're in the midst of a cultural cycle in which certain types and expressions of religion are indeed constituting a form of tyranny over the mind of man, the human mind, then the presence of strong and vibrant and growing religious communities that celebrate both the harmony and the flowering of the human mind, heart, soul, and spirit is more crucial than ever. And just so I don't sound chauvinistic or provincial, I would quickly add that religious communities like these do not, indeed not, all bear the name Unitarian Universalist. We're not the only show in town or the only religious body on the societal landscape when it comes to being religious liberals. And given our size, that is a good thing. But we do have our own tradition of a critical faith to uphold. And as I say, that in fact is one of the reasons why we are here. And it is one of the reasons that we come together here to share our lives and to find spiritual nurture for our lives, even as we seek to attend to the needs and the demands of the larger world. This is the final installment of a 3-sermon series I've been doing on my understanding of what faith is as a religious liberal. The first 2 sermons dealt with the subject largely on a personal level. Today, as you have seen, I have moved to a more societal and institutional level. But I'm going to loop back to the personal for a few moments now before finishing up, while also looking ahead to next Sunday's service, where, as Steve LeBue was already giving you the heads up on that, we'll be launching our annual pledge drive. And yes, a pledge drive is about money. For if faith alone were legal currency, we could fund our programs, pay our bills, and compensate our staff without having to ask for financial pledges, but that's not the way the world works in which we live. That said, however, pledging your financial support to us to the greatest extent you are able to do so is not entirely about money. It also has to do, and this is what I want you to give some thought for, it also has to do with how you answer the question of why are we here? I'll take my shot at it as succinctly as I can. I'm going to say that we're here for 3 reasons. To have a place to stand, to have a place to be, and to have a place from which we can respond to the larger life of our community, nation, and world. Let's take them one at a time. A place to stand. A place to stand on some of the faith precepts I've spoken to over the previous 2 weeks and this morning. A place to affirm, celebrate, and experience the power of the human spirit, the power of the spirit of life, and the presence of that which, however you call it, dwells within each one of us, while also linking us to one another and to the world and all of life. Beyond us. 2, a place to be. A place to be with one another and sharing this kind of faith. A place to learn from one another about how we each and all find meaning and purpose and direction in our lives and how we each and all give our voice to it. A place to be with one another as we encounter some of life's greatest joys and suffer some of life's greatest pains, setbacks, and losses, the kinds of which we share here almost Sunday to Sunday. A place we can say to a fellow member or friend, when you know the need is there, same thing our choir sang a little earlier, lean on me. A place to be stretching our free minds and exercising our free spirit. A place for fun and for learning. And for knowing the joy of human fellowship and the gift of human love and compassion. A place to be with our children, biologically related or not, They're all our children. Over there, in that other wing, a place to be with our children as they too learn the joys and challenges, the rewards and the demands of a free faith. And third, a place from which we respond to and engage our values with the greater life of our community, nation, and world. When faith is put forth as the antithesis of, or even as the antidote to, human reason, and when religion is proffered as a counterforce to scientific inquiry, and when, to get down to a case for just a moment, when religion is used as a rationale for denying the acceptance, affirmation, and full civil rights for gay and lesbian persons, then we need strong communities of faith that will say no to this kind of perversion of religion and faith, and yes to those universal principles and values that have, over the course of human history, moved us, however slowly and haltingly, in the direction of a more just and humane world, and that have preserved and nurtured the best that is found within the human spirit. We need strong communities of faith who will say we're not going to sit still for this kind of undermining of the positive role that religion at its very best can play in a free and open society. So let me close with this. As we look ahead to next week and the weeks to follow, one of my colleagues in the UU ministry, the Reverend Chris Weiss, he's at the UU Church in Knoxville, Tennessee. In a pre-pledge drive sermon that he gave, he told his congregation, "This church is free because we pay for it." Now that's a pretty good line. One of those ones I wish I thought of myself. But since I did, I'll use his. "This church is free because we pay for it." I hope you'll bear that thought in mind over the next few weeks. To play with that line just a little bit, I'll add, this church will be the embodiment and representation of a free faith, as I have tried to speak to it in recent weeks, only as long as we pay for it, and only as we continue to lessen our dependence upon those who paid for it in the past. And you'll hear more about that, I'm sure, next Sunday. To conclude, we as citizens of this nation remain in the debt of those who, even with all the serious imperfections by which they were bound in their time, still strove to make the free mind and the free spirit the basis of how we would govern ourselves as a nation. And we in this congregation are in the debt of those who believe that men and women could be persons of faith and could form communities of faith that could meaningfully engage with the world and with the new age of inquiry that they saw dawning before. To their wisdom, I would add that of the late African-American novelist and essayist James Baldwin, who once said, "The minute we cease to hold one another, the minute we break faith with one another, the light goes out and the darkness engulfs us. We are bearers of the light, of truth, the free mind and spirit, of justice, and of love." May we keep faith with our call to keep it glowing. May we sing together our closing hymn, number 145.